Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zengerer. This week on The Money...
Where we have some very high net worth individuals able to tax plan through super, that actually doesn't help the budget and it doesn't really help anyone.
Labor announces its plans to cut super tax concessions, but will they be too difficult to implement?
Unfortunately, I think Glenn Stevens realises that his hands are tied to a large extent, and that we may need to rely more on some form of fiscal stimulus or fiscal policy.
We'll find out why Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens wants the government to spend, not cut, in this year's budget. And reviewing the minimum wage pitches business, unions and think tanks against each other after the Australian Federation of Employers says businesses can't afford to pay a living wage. That's all coming up. You're on the Money.
A wealthy retired person can have $12 million in their superannuation account, pay no tax at all on the dividend, and be given a tax refund from the government of $250,000.
Superannuation has been in the headlines lately with a growing push for the government to address super tax concessions that have allowed thousands of Australians to pour millions of dollars into their super funds tax-free. It's an issue Labor is keen to grab hold of in the lead-up to next month's budget.
It would be irresponsible of any political party not to address this question of the largesse of the 47 cents concessions the multimillionaires received from the taxpayer.
Labor released its second major policy initiative, hot on the heels of last month's plan to bring $1.9 billion back into the budget by clamping down on tax avoidance strategies and beefing up the ATO's ability to investigate companies who may be paying less than they should.
This is a very important quality structural addition to the long-term budget, and this underpins Labor's fiscal approach.
In a joint press conference, Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen and opposition leader Bill Shorten pushed their plan to address the growing clamour over super tax concessions, which cost the budget bottom line $35 billion every year. Currently, earnings from super are tax-free if you're over 60. Labor plans to change this rule to tax super earnings of more than $75,000 at 15% instead. They also plan to drop the threshold for the so-called high-income superannuation charge from $300,000 to $250,000. Labor says the plan, which has been fully costed by the Independent Parliamentary Budget Office, will save $14 billion a year over 10 years and will make the superannuation system more sustainable. They also say the plan will take pressure off the age pension, something all economists agree is necessary in the face of an ageing population. But the self-managed super industry says taxing super earnings and contributions would affect people's savings habits and reduce the incentive for people to save more. While the Grattan Institute says the plan does not go nearly far enough. The Institute's chief executive, John Daly, says all earnings from super should be taxed at 15%, not just those over $75,000, to help address the $40 billion budget deficit. Here he is on the ABC's Q&A program recently.
And then you have the top 20%, on average about $2 million in wealth, on average earning more outside of superannuation than they would get on a full age pension. And then on top of that, as well, on average, earning almost as much in superannuation as a full age pension. So we have a system in which superannuation has essentially become not what it was originally designed for, which was to support the incomes of that middle 60%, but instead it's become something which is essentially a tax shelter for the top 20%, the precise people who need the least help.
Daly says if you taxed all earnings in the pensions phase at 15%, that would raise about $3 billion a year. But the government has already rejected Labor's proposal. Treasurer Joe Hockey says he's philosophically opposed to higher taxes.
The reason why I'm cautious is because it's money, it's their money. I'm always cautious about taking people's money off them, right?
The Treasurer says the federal government will be focusing on reducing spending in the upcoming budget. Opposition leader Bill Shorten says the Labor Party is addressing a legacy issue from the Howard government era.
Something went wrong about 2006 when Peter Costello and John Howard took off any break when they provided practically unlimited tax concessions to people who have millions and millions of dollars.
Bill Shorten says thanks to the Howard government years, super tax concessions are now out of control. But is he right? Rosalie De Gabriella is a superannuation specialist at the UTS Business School.
In 2006, there were some major tax concession changes. This was the Howard Costello 2006 budget, in which they abolished the taxation on any superannuation over the age of 60, and they reduced the taxation on other contributions to 15%. So this is a major concession. And then they allowed wealthy individuals to put up to $1 million into their superannuation funds. And there was a window on this of about 12 months. So the result of this, a lot of money flowed into superannuation. And this is when these generous concessions of no tax on superannuation earnings over the age of 60 first came into being.
So at the moment we have a situation where $35 billion in super tax concessions is kind of flowing out, if you like, of the annual budget every year. That's money that we're foregoing, if you like, in the annual budget. And at the moment we're faced with a $40 billion deficit. It kind of seems at odds, doesn't it, with a government saying we need to urgently return to surplus, although Joe Hockey is kind of backpedalling on when that might be at the moment, and yet saying that they're not prepared to address this in terms of the super tax concessions.
Yes, the problem with a lot of the superannuation, and there's a couple of issues that come up here, is one, we really have constant regime changes in superannuation. And I think everybody is actually striving to get to a point where we have a position in superannuation which is equitable to all players and that it doesn't need further changing. But then by the same token, superannuation in Australia is still relatively a young beast, and so we are having to massage it along with the demographic changes in the population. So I'm afraid that certain people make this partisan, which is really quite sad. We do have a lot of middle class welfare, and I would consider some of these tax concessions and superannuation really do come under that guise.
I guess people like the Association of Super Funds Australia and the Financial Services Council, they say the purpose of superannuation is to ease pressure on the public purse. They want to see more Australians get on to being able to manage their retirement through their own savings. Does the super scheme as it is at the moment, and will it going forward, really ease the pressure on the budget?
It certainly will, but by the same token, we need some sort of equitable well-being for all of the population. And where we have some very high net worth individuals able to tax plan through super, that actually doesn't help the budget and it doesn't really help anyone. We really need to strive to get some sort of equitability. And while we're also talking about 15% tax rate or the no tax rate, we've also got to remember that a lot of the earnings of superannuation funds are affected or impacted positively by franking credits, and that means even further less revenue for a government.
So can you explain how that works?
We've got franking credits on dividends issued by companies to avoid the double taxation of dividends.
So that means if, for example, the company's already paid tax on the dividend, then you don't have to.
Exactly. So that benefits a lot of superannuation fund earnings as well. So we've got a number of little holes that appear right across the superannuation gambit. Now, I don't disagree with ASFA or ASCII or any of those associations that superannuation planning is with regards to providing retirement outcomes for the various members. But by the same token, we do need to actually create some flow of income back into the, you know, government coffers.
What people like the self-managed funds representatives say is that they're concerned that any changes to taxation on superannuation will affect people's savings habits and they'll reduce the incentive to save more. Do you agree that that's likely to happen?
No, I think that's a very easy comment to come, not just from SMSF, but from any group. The fact is that the kind of changes that the Labor Party is currently mooting, and I'm sure the Liberal Party would have equally if they had been the first to say this. Really, they're targeted high net worth individuals. We're really talking about balances of $2 million and above. Generally, the persons who've managed to accumulate that sort of money, we're not talking about week-to-week saving or even year-to-year savings. These are wealthy individuals. So I don't think that's a valid comment when we're talking about the top, I think it's 5 or 10% of the population.
What the Financial Services Council have said is that they are concerned that this scheme is going to be too complex to implement in a similar way that a previous scheme that was proposed by the Gillard government to introduce tax on superannuation earnings over $100,000 was seen to be too complicated. Do you think that this scheme has those kind of complications in it that would make it too hard? It seems to be reasonably straightforward, doesn't it?
Well, I've certainly heard this argument, and I did hear this argument the last time around as well. And actually, I thought the previous scheme, which had a benchmark of $100,000, was probably a better one. I would have thought with complex computer schemes that we now have and all sorts of data collection that really, yes, there will be a cost, but surely I would think as an accountant this is doable. I'm not saying it's free of cost in the initial phase, but I think it's doable. And certainly it was doable prior to 2006.
Okay, what do you think of the government's response to the Labor Party's super plan, their proposed changes to the superannuation tax concessions? The government has said that this is just another tax, and Joe Hockey, the Treasurer, said that this government is opposed to higher taxes. So they don't seem to want to go there at all in terms of addressing this issue of the $35 billion in tax concessions that are flowing out every year of the budget.
I think my answer to the Liberal Party or the current government would be that we need to be bipartisan. And yes, we do need to look at a complete package of tax reform across all the areas. There are lots of leakages in the tax system. But certainly this is a big one. It's a big one that is easily identifiable. It's a big one that goes to a particular group and probably one of the more direct ones that can be solved. I still, of course, would like to see them solve some of the other ones that have been discussing in Canberra over the last week or two. But I think it's a helpful drop in the bucket. And in Joe Hockey language, you know, you fill up a bucket one drop at a time, and this is a few drops going in.
Rosalie de Gabriella, lecturer in finance at the UTS Business School.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
You're with me, Catherine Zengerer. Well, every month, homeowners, property investors and potential buyers eagerly await the news of what the Reserve Bank's decision will be on interest rates, particularly in the hot Sydney and Melbourne markets, which are stimulated by interest rate cuts. But when the RBA board sits down to make its decision, the property market in Sydney is only one consideration. Also on their minds is how to stimulate a slowing economy. Despite the need to control the property bubble, the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens says they could make another 0.25% cut in May. But he says other measures may be needed to get the economy moving, measures like fiscal stimulus. And this means he wants Treasurer Joe Hockey to do some spending, not cutting, in the upcoming budget. Roderick Chambers has more.
We keep getting told that our commodities prices are down, led by our biggest export, iron ore, and that this is why our economy is heading into troubled waters. The Reserve Bank had hoped that housing and construction could help plug the yawning gap that was opening up because of this. But they now have a new conundrum, a property bubble in Sydney and Melbourne that is not reflected elsewhere in Australia. Paul Mazzola is a lecturer in finance and economics at the University of Wollongong. Paul, what can the government do in the upcoming budget to stimulate the economy?
Well, I suspect any infrastructure-related investment would be useful, and that is anything that could increase Australia's productivity. Things like ports, rail and road transport, and other infrastructure that's relevant for industry.
Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens has said as much by commenting that monetary policy was becoming ineffective without support from fiscal policy. What do you think of that?
That's a very good comment, and I think Glenn Stevens has hit the nail on the head. He's very, very well aware of an economic concept called the liquidity trap. It's not a new concept. It's actually one developed by Keynes, and it's a concept that says that when interest rates are very low, close to zero, and consumption demand is relatively inelastic. That is, that there is low consumer confidence, and regardless where you take monetary policy, it has very negligible effect or stimulation to the economy, then any reduction in interest rates is ineffective. So Glenn Stevens realises that we're just over 2%. To bring the interest rates down even by 0.25%, in real terms, given that our most recent inflation rate has been annualised at 1.7%, we are being taken down to close to 0%. Statistics have shown that our stimulatory monetary policy has had little effect on credit growth. Instead, what it has done has prompted investors to push up or to buy assets such as houses, such as shares. I think we've just got to have a look at what the share prices have done and what the house prices have done, and they've gone up. So rather than stimulate economic activity, which is what the primary outcome of this stimulatory policy should be in terms of promoting consumption, it's gone into asset prices. And we've seen this in the States following the global financial crisis. We saw it happening in Japan as well, where they've actually had effective 0% interest rates and have had great difficulty at stimulating their economy. And now we're experiencing this also in Australia. So, unfortunately, I think Glenn Stevens realises that his hands are tied to a large extent and that we may need to rely more on some form of fiscal stimulus or fiscal policy.
How significant is the plummeting oil price for the economy, do you think?
It has had a significant effect. The international investment community treats Australia as a large commodity bowl, and iron ore is one of our major commodity exports. So therefore, as the price of iron ore drops, so does investment in that particular industry. Similarly, the government's tax take, as the profits decrease from the producers and all the ancillary industries that rely on the iron ore industry, the tax take comes down as well. So the government's affected as well as the industry.
Well, there was much made of the international trade agreement with China, citing industries such as dairy and other primary produce that could be expanded greatly. Would this help balance the books?
I think that thinking of relying on primary production, whether it's in the form of agriculture or minerals, is a little bit out of date for Australia. I think we've got to move away from that sort of reliance. And that brings us to the question, where else can Australia go? And the obvious answer is in the tertiary sector, and that is, you know, the services industries. You see that the more sophisticated economies do have burgeoning services industries. And Australia has led the way in a number of these, whether they're professional service firms, whether it's education or some other industry. The other thing where Australia could do better, I think, is in innovation. We tend to lose a lot of our smart creations or inventions or whatever you might want to put it, and we're not fostering that sort of technology and innovation. Technology innovation is, however, a function of research and education. And we must just then ask ourselves, well, what is the government doing in that sector? Has the government got the right policy mix or the right fiscal stimulus in that research, the innovation and the education sector? Well, the answer is no. In fact, what they're doing is actually cutting expenditure in research at universities and not really promoting the research in private practice either.
Yes, even the CSIRO had to make cuts. So do you think the upcoming budget might see some money for the Department of Infrastructure and Regional Development, for instance?
I hope so. I think some targeted spending in infrastructure would not only help the unemployment rate, and that is allowing the entrance into the workforce of those previously unable to get into the workforce. And remembering, we're sort of levelling off or even increasing our unemployment rate from the level of around 6%. And there's little likelihood in the terms of forecasting that that level would come down below that in the next 12 months. So some spending in infrastructure would be helpful in that regard. The ongoing multiplier effect into the economy would also be of assistance. And perhaps even some other fiscal stimulus in regards to taxation and any other form that would stimulate the economy into spending rather than reducing interest rates, which essentially either goes into assets or asset prices or reducing mortgages, which again is unproductive to the economy.
So it's over to Joe Hockey.
I think so. I got a budget.
Paul Mazzola, he's a lecturer in the School of Accounting, Economics and Finance at the University of Wollongong's Faculty of Business. He was speaking with Roderick Chambers.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
You're with me, Catherine Zengara. The Fair Work Commission is currently reviewing the minimum wage, and businesses and conservative governments are calling on the Commission to exercise restraint in its decision. Restraint in this instance means a lower than inflation increase or no increase at all. The federal government even goes so far as to argue increasing wages is not the best way to help the unemployed, that benefits delivered through the tax transfer system are a better way of boosting the living standards of the low paid. This report by Stephen Regal.
It's interesting the arguments that are often put up. Minimum wage rate increases. When the economy is doing very, very well and when business is doing very, very well, we're told that we can't have a reasonable rise in the minimum wage because that could lead to a wages breakout and we'll have inflation and then the Reserve Bank will have to clamp down with higher interest rates. When the economy is not doing as well, we're told, well, we can't afford a minimum wage because business couldn't possibly support that. The reality is that business groups will never say that we should have a reasonable minimum wage increase. They have an argument regardless of how their businesses are going.
Matt Grudenoff, economist at the Australia Institute, speaking there. The Fair Work Commission is due to make a decision on the minimum wage sometime later this year. Last year, the Commission approved a 3% increase to the minimum wage of around $18 per week, which equates to $16.87 an hour, or $640 per week. At the time, employers warned it would hurt the economy. President of the Commission, Ian Ross, argued at the time there was no threat to inflation, then sitting at 2.7% with the increase. Now with inflation at one percentage point lower, employers are urging the Fair Work Commission to go easy on any new rises.
What you have to look at, I think, is where we stand in the world of minimum rates of pay. We're about the fourth highest minimum rate of pay in the world. So therefore, if you look at the jobs at which people try to enter the workforce, employers are not attracted to engaging them. So there is a big question about whether or not you pay more and have fewer jobs, or you try to life up with the rest of the world and create jobs at that very important threshold entry level into the workforce.
Gary Brack, Chief Executive of the Australian Federation of Employers and Industry, speaking there. His argument is common among the industry submissions to the Fair Work's wage review. The Australian National Retail Association argues the prices of retail goods rose below inflation last year and sales were below trend rates. The Accommodation Association of Australia, which represents the interests of hotels and the like, report poor trading conditions due to reduced domestic spending. And the Restaurant and Catering Industry Association complains about slim profit margins. But Matt Grudenoff from the Australia Institute questions the viability of companies that are unable to pay the minimum wage.
If you can't make a profit paying the minimum wage, then you can't make a profit. The minimum wage represents a support for workers so that they aren't exploited and aren't paid a wage that they can't possibly live off. You could make the same argument about tax. You know, if the business was completely exempt from tax, there are some businesses that would be profitable, but if they were subject to tax, maybe they wouldn't be profitable.
And industry's response?
Well, I think that's a kind of stupid thing you'd expect to come out of the Australia Institute. They're a bunch of lefties. They have their own particular view. Let them argue that view.
Gary Brack from the Federation of Employers and Industry says merely raising wages will not lift people out of entry-level positions.
You can't create a living wage concept at that minimum wage level because the market simply cannot afford to absorb those people into the workforce at high costs, which the market won't actually remunerate.
That's an interesting thing that you just said there. You're talking about a living wage concept. So you're basically saying that businesses should be able to pay people below a living wage, that the government should pick up the rest.
Well, what we're saying is that you've got two choices. If you want to push wages up beyond the capacity of the market to fund those costs, then you won't have the jobs. If that's what you're advocating, then we're talking about something completely different.
So could a wage rise lead to greater unemployment for those who can least handle it? Professor of Economics at the University of Western Sydney, Raja Junaka, says there is no link between youth unemployment and wage levels.
If you look at the data on youth wages compared to adult wages, what you find over the past few years, decades, the youth wages have been falling relative to adult wages. So clearly, what's happened now is that youth unemployment rates have gone up significantly since the global financial crisis. And this has nothing to do with youth wages. And similarly, if you look at youth minimum wages, youth minimum wages have been more or less constant over the last, say, 5 or 10 years, but the youth unemployment rates have been rising quite significantly. So again, if there's no clear relationship between minimum wages and youth unemployment.
The unemployment rate for March was 6.1%, with youth unemployment at 13.7%. But it's not only people in the paid labour market who are raising concerns. Co-founder of Interns Australia, Colleen Chen, says unpaid internships are symptomatic of growing youth unemployment.
Unpaid internships are symptomatic of youth unemployment. Increasingly, we're seeing a shift to expecting young people with experience in the workplace to apply for entry-level jobs. So to do that, a lot of young people without sufficient information on what their workplace rights are starting to take on unpaid internships. And from our research, we've discovered that a lot of these unpaid internships, in fact, do not fall within what is allowed under the Fair Work Act, and they are, in effect, illegal, and unpaid interns are entitled to back pay in these situations.
Colleen Chen, who is the co-founder of Interns Australia, speaking now.
That report was produced by Stephen Regal and Claire Armstrong. That's it for On the Money this week. Thanks to our reporters Roderick Chambers, Stephen Regal and Claire Armstrong. You can find all our podcasts at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and please like us on Facebook. Look for 2ser On the Money. I'm Catherine Zengara. Thanks for your company.